welcome to a very special City of Fremantle Hungerford Award edition of the Fremantle Press podcast. This year, the City of Fremantle Hungerford Award will celebrate its 30th anniversary, and our judges, Sisonke Seaman, Brenda Walker and Richard Rossiter, are hard at work judging the 70 manuscripts currently in contention. As you'll note, I'm not your usual Rebecca. My name is Jay Martin, and I was the winner of the 2016 City of Fremantle Hungerford Award with my book, Vodka and Apple Juice, Travels of an Undiplomatic Wife in Poland. About my attempt to be a diplomatic wife in Poland, which I usually say was largely unsuccessful, but certainly interesting. Since winning, I've gone through the ups and downs of having my book reviewed. I've been featured in the Western Australian magazine. I've been interviewed on ABC Radio and BBC Radio Canada, and been a guest at several international writers' festivals, none of which I could have imagined when I was writing the book on a borrowed iPad on my daily commute along Canning Highway on the 111 bus. Today, I'm with an author who's at the very beginning of her publication journey. Julie Sprigg was shortlisted for the 2018 City of Fremantle Hungerford Award for her book about her time working as a physio and a self-confessed do-gooder in Ethiopia, Small Steps. A well-deserved congratulations on that, Julie, and welcome.
Thanks, Jay. It's lovely to be here.
Great to have. The book takes place in 2004. When did you write it? And can you tell us a little bit about your road to publication?
Sure. So the book covers the period of 2004 to 2006. So I initially started pulling my journal entries together into a manuscript in 2008. And then I completed the first draft over the period of about 2 years. But that was also was quite slow going because I was working full-time in foreign aid. I was working a very stressful job. I was studying a master's degree. So I very, very slowly put together a manuscript. And then I put it down for a couple of years and thought, oh, this is probably not going to go anywhere. I'm a bit too busy. And then I eventually started working on it again in about 2014, and I did manage to get it to completion, and I pitched to about six different publishing houses, and I didn't have any success. And so then a really vital step on my path to publication was that I had an opportunity with Catherine Susanna Pritchard Writers' Centre, and I was selected from some workshop participants in a session called Get Your Work Noticed by Publishers. So I had some mentoring sessions from a publisher from a very small publishing house, and she helped me review my pitch, my submission, my first three chapters, and she gave me really good feedback that my manuscript was way too long. So then I spent a long time redrafting my manuscript and cutting huge swathes of it out. And then I did submit it to another publisher, and I had some interest from my pitch, but they didn't proceed with the manuscript. And then got to 2017, then I had a baby, and then I thought, well, it's too late. This book is not going to go anywhere now. But then when the Hungerford Award entries were announced, I thought, I'll just give it one last shot. So I entered it in the 2018 Hungerford Award, and then it was shortlisted, and then I was offered a publishing contract as a result of the shortlisting process. And here I am today as an almost published author.
Wow, so that persistence really paid off then.
Yes, exactly. Persistence and consistency.
Great to hear. So both of us wrote books about living somewhere else, and both of us were actually quite well-travelled when we wrote those books. But it seemed to me that both of us were really surprised by the reaction to living overseas in the new roles that we were taking on, even though our roles couldn't have been more different. What were some of the things you hadn't expected about living in Ethiopia, both in terms of what living there was like for you and your reaction to it?
Well, the major thing that surprised me was not that it was hard, but that I found it hard. Because I was so blithely optimistic, and because I was a very experienced backpacker, I'd lived in the UK for a couple of years. I'd backpacked on my own around South America for a couple of months. When I worked in London, I worked in a hospital where all my patients were from the Middle East and we only spoke Arabic and we had to use interpreters. And I'd spent heaps of time with asylum seekers in Australia. So I was very used to working in a cross-cultural environment, and I had been in places where there was a lot of poverty. So I just thought, oh, other people will probably find it hard, but I won't, because I'll be fine. And it turned out that I was totally unprepared for the difference between backpacking and living in a developing country and working in that country. So before I went, their head sister, the real sister Starling, who's a character in the book, she had emailed me along the lines of do some preparation because it's very different to live and work in a developing country than backpack through. And I actually thought at the time, old people, they just don't know what they're talking about. And so then I got to Ethiopia and surprise, it was really difficult. And I was completely floored by how difficult I found it. So that was one aspect. And the other aspect that I was unprepared for, and Jay, you might have found this too, I was unprepared for culture shock and I was unprepared for how hard it hit me. So in the book, the part of my story, I spent some time living with nuns, and so I was relatively separate from the sort of the wider world. So during the day, I saw things that were very different from home, but then my living conditions were quite safe and quite comfortable, although they were quite Spartan, as you'd expect in a convent. But when I got to Gondar, and I was completely on my own and completely having to operate within a very different culture, I was completely unprepared for just how much shock would be involved in that. And it, for me, and I'm not sure if you felt the same with this, Jay, it was less about the scale of how different things were. It was more that absolutely everything was different. So the way I brushed my teeth, the way I had a shower and got ready for work, a caseload that was just completely, vastly different from what I had at home, how I got my dinner in the evening, how I had a shower before I went to bed, nothing was familiar. And so my entire day was brand new experiences and new ways of navigating in the world. And I just, I didn't have any sense of how that was going to deplete my sense of resilience or my emotional reserves. So Those were the two major things that I didn't expect and I was completely unprepared for.
It's funny you say that because I actually do understand exactly what you're saying about that, depleting your reserves from every single thing being new. But, of course, I wasn't living with nuns and you mentioned that. What was it like to live in a nunnery with those women?
Yes, like I said with my previous answer, I was blithely optimistic that that was going to be easy too. So in a similar thought process, I thought, oh, well, I went to Catholic school. I've been to prayers. I've been to church on Sundays. And as I mentioned in the book, after I finished school, then sometimes I would go back to church on a Sunday when I felt a bit rudderless or when I wanted some familiarity. And so I genuinely thought, oh, well, I'm used to that sort of thing. So how hard could it be to live with nuns? And even when I had friends that suggested that it might be difficult, I was completely adamant it was just going to be fine, and it was just a really good chance to reflect on things. And turns out that it was really hard to live with nuns. Who would have thought? So the first house that I went to stay in was a formation house, which is where the postulant sisters go. And those are the sisters that are new to the order and they stay there for 2 years before they take their vows. So by necessity, those formation houses need to be houses of discipline and quiet and regular routine and regimen because that is the life that the sisters are entering. But that is completely an unsuitable place for a 20-something from Perth that's lived in a share house and does love to do a bit of partying now and then. So turned out that it was really a very challenging place to stay, but I have to say that the second and third places that I stayed with one of the characters called Sister Almaz, that those houses were not formation houses. They were more relaxed houses because they were focused on sisters living in the community and doing their work. And those places were actually wonderful places to stay, where there was an amazing sense of community. And was just an opportunity like I've not had before or since to live with a number of really strong and compassionate women with really progressive social views and we would spend our evenings dining together and then having really interesting conversations and doing the dishes together and praying together as well, which turned out I did get used to practicing after a while, spending long times in chapel. So it turned out, again, to be completely not what I'd expected because I hadn't really put much thought into what I should expect. And so I had these two really diverse experiences, but both of them turned out to be really amazing.
Yeah, this wasn't my world. And so I found your description of the nuns and life there really interesting and something that was very new to me and that really gave me a different sense of what it must have been like. And I have to say that I had the same experience when I read about your experience of working actually as a physiotherapist, obviously very different from my experience of going to the physio here in Perth when you've got a sore knee or whatever the problem was. But I really liked how you do talk a lot about the different children that you meet and the physiotherapy treatments that you actually undertake with them. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of those children and the experience of working with them as a physio?
Sure. One of the really common issues that we faced were kids with TB of the spine. And so up until going to Ethiopia, I'd not really heard of TB of the spine. And so we had lots and lots of girls sort of in primary school who would come who'd been paralysed with TB of the spine. And once they were in the hospital and they had treatment, then once the medication kicked in, then the physiotherapy was really important for regaining their ability to walk and therefore be able to do things like go back to school and play with their friends and sort of have a similar sort of life to their little pal. And that was one of my primary motivations for writing the book, because the experience of working with them was so unlike the experience that you would get working as a physiotherapist in Australia, but also at its heart was also the same, because it still involved the same diagnostic skills and the same skills of being able to work out a treatment plan and being able to implement that treatment plan.
Yeah, wow, really something that gives you a different sense of what physios contribute to rehabilitation and therapy. It's great to have that documented. So, Julie, I do have to ask, you do talk in your book about having a romantic relationship with a colleague that you met at the hospital, Tedessa. I'm really curious, what was he like? How did you meet it? How did you fall for him?
Oh, well, we met because we worked together in the hospital, so we saw each other every single day, and we had a lot of time together, and we also socialised together as colleagues. We spent a lot of time going to the town's nightclubs and having Friday afternoon drinks in the Tukul, which was a place where all the staff would gather and sort of have Friday afternoon drinks, which was also fun. And what was he like? Well, he was quite dashing, actually, as you would expect from a romantic hero. So, he's an incredibly caring nature and a really strong voice for social justice. And we had a lot of similar interests to do with culture and language. So we used to talk for hours and hours and hours. And a lot of that didn't make the final cut of the book because it's been not very interesting to read about people talking for a long time. But we did spend a lot of time dancing together and dancing until the wee hours of the morning and having lots of fun. And so I guess that from that, a relationship blossomed. So Tedessa is also one of the wisest people I've ever met. So there are a lot of times when I was feeling like I was floundering and not really knowing how to go about in this world. And so Tedessa was that voice of reason. He's incredibly grounded and he was able to keep me grounded as well.
The way that you talk about him, it sounds like he's really still a very special person to you.
Yes, he is. Yeah, he remains a person who's really important in my life. And whenever there's really important decisions that I need a sounding board for, then Tedessa is often the person that I turn to. I feel really blessed to have known him, actually, and I really feel that there really isn't that many people in the world like Tedessa. So, for example, as an extra anecdote, which isn't in the book, so it's a little bonus, but after I left Ethiopia, some of the people in the book were out together and someone got their purse stolen, and Tedessa chased after the thief they got the purse back and he told the thief off. And I just think that's a brilliant example of, he's just a person of integrity and he'll go above and beyond for people.
So I'm curious, I mean, did that relationship with Tedessa change your interactions with or your relationship to the community while you were there?
Yes, absolutely. Because like with any lovely relationship, you get to know people's families, you get to know their circle of friends and you start to build mutual circles of friends. So then I felt so much more grounded in the community because I had these really close relationships and deep connections with people. So it absolutely did change the nature of the time that I spent there.
Yeah, you talked earlier about some of the really big challenges of these difficult health and personal situations of the children that you were dealing with in the hospitals in Ethiopia. But your book also really shares a lot of the really minor challenges of living in a difficult environment like that. Can you recount for us maybe some of the more minor things that you write about and your reaction to them looking back?
Yes. So I included some of those minor aspects because each of them are minor and some of them are entertaining if you're a backpacker and just passing through. But sometimes they can build up and they tend to erode they eroded my sort of resilience. So one of them was the toilet seats. So it's really rare to find a toilet seat that had stayed connected to the rim. And I'm not sure why, whether it was an issue of the toilet seats that were available. But, so often you would find if there was a ferengi, which is the word that people used in Ethiopia for foreigners, if there was a ferengi-style toilet and not a squat toilet, 9 times out of 10, the seat wouldn't be connected to the rim, which... it's only minor, but then you'd either have to sort of hover above the toilet seat or you'd have to approach very gingerly. Otherwise, if you get the angle wrong, you'd actually fall off the toilet seat and land on the floor if you went a little bit too fast. And so the other thing was that sometimes there would just be no toilet seat at all. And particularly in Addis Ababa, where the altitude is the same as the summit of Mount Kosciuszko. So because it's so mountainous, it gets freezing in the nighttime. So sitting on freezing cold porcelain with very hard edges is really, really uncomfortable when you need to use the amenities in the middle of the night. And it sounds like such a minor thing, but every single day over a course of a couple of years, when you've already got your resources sort of depleted by other things, toilet seats, they're just a minor thing, but they featured so prominently in my daily thought processes that they naturally seem to occur in the narrative.
And I think you're absolutely right. You know, they seem like minor things, and they are if you're just traveling for a couple of weeks. But I certainly know from my own experience and from writing it as well that, you know, when you're living in another country full time, those things can really add up and become something that in summary becomes a real challenge, can't they?
Yes, absolutely. And it seems ridiculous that 15 years later, we're talking about toilet seats, but they featured quite prominently. So the other thing that really featured was the environmental noise, and I write about it quite a bit in the book, that I just had no idea how much environmental noise we're not exposed to in Australia. So wherever I was staying, and I don't know whether it was just where I was staying or every single place I went to, you can always hear prayers from the Ethiopian Orthodox churches, and they're usually multiple churches within walking distance. And those prayers are broadcast on a megaphone, and they could go for hours and hours and hours and hours at any time of the day or night. So, and I did talk to Tedessa about this, and he said it's helpful, you know, it's useful. If you're not at church, you can still hear the prayers, which is really great. But those prayers are in Ge'ez, which is the scriptural language of Ethiopia. So I didn't understand the Ge'ez prayers. And there's a constant source of noise. But then at the same time, where I lived in Gondar was also walking distance to 5 different mosques. So then you'd have the Muslim call to prayer at the different set times of night. So then you'd have often 2 different sets of prayers, often concurrently. And then You might get some silence for a few hours, and then perhaps there might be a political event or a social event. And the way that that will be broadcast is that somebody would drive around with a ute and a megaphone, and they would be calling that out, and that would be in the, could be in the early hours of the morning or in the evening. And then there would also be music coming from minivans. So one of the things that I write about is the political song. There was one song that had very strong political meaning at the time of the elections, and the elections do feature quite a bit in my book, because coming from Australia, I'm not used to anything other than the democratic process, which I've grown up with. So there were some issues with perhaps the democratic process not being implemented as to plan. And so there was this political activist who had a song that everybody played all the time. And it could be played from minibuses at full volume at 5 a.m. or from a tape shop at full volume any hour of day and night. And I think why I wanted to include that in the book is because it's just so different to what we have in Australia. So if somebody plays a song at 5 a.m. at full volume here, you can call the police, because it fits outside of our council legislation of noise regulation. And there were so many times I lay in bed at 2 o'clock in the morning just thinking, oh, please, can everyone be quiet so I can have some sleep? And, again, very funny if you're backpacking through an area, and very funny if you know that a few nights later you're going to get some sleep, but really difficult if night after night after night you're not getting any sleep. But the reason I also wanted to include it is because there's a trade-off of that sort of our highly ordered, sort of predictable and highly legislated environment where you're not allowed to make noise and you're not really allowed to go around broadcasting things from megaphones into people's houses. But that comes with a decrease in vibrancy. So you can go for a walk in Australia and you might not hear any other noise except for a lawnmower or a whippersnipper or a car. But in Ethiopia, where I lived in Gondar, if we'd go for a walk and I'd hear kids and dogs and donkeys and the hip-hop barbershop that just had hip-hop music blaring all day, people calling out hello, and there was so much more vibrancy and life outside. So I felt like it was important to include that because it gave such a different sense of how life is so different there than here.
Sounds fascinating. And I think you're touching on another thing that I was going to ask you about today, actually, which is about decisions about what to put in a book and what to not include in a book, because both of our books are, of course, classified as narrative nonfiction, or as they like to say in Hollywood, based on a true story. And, you know, there are decisions when you're doing that about what you leave in and what you take out. So I'm curious about what kind of decisions you had to make and how you went about making those decisions about writing things that really did happen to people and in a country that you're writing about.
That is a really excellent question. And I just faced so many decisions, and I feel like we could have an entire podcast just about this. And I feel like it was so much about the story was shaped by not what was in it, but what wasn't in it. Because when I came back from Ethiopia, I had hundreds of thousands of words worth of journal entries. And I think you might have said that you had sort of similar amounts.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Yeah, so then that process of whittling away what goes in was one of the reasons why it took so long to complete that first draft. So one of my really important ways was being really critical about how does this progress the narrative. And there were lots of anecdotes that I wanted to include, or lots of people's stories, but I found in the end if they didn't progress the narrative, that they just ended up on the cutting room floor. And is that similar to the process that you took, Jay?
It's funny that you say that. I actually had a beta reader who read an early version of it, and she wanted to cut a few scenes. And I said, but I love that scene. And she said, sometimes the best scenes still have to end up on a cutting room floor. So that was very good advice, because exactly as you said, I came to the same decisions as you, that it needs to take the story forward, the story that I'm trying to tell, and the wrong details at the wrong time can actually get in the way of that.
Yes, absolutely. And another thing which I discovered was that I set out thinking I was going to write about a particular sort of set of themes, but then as I wrote, those themes sort of fell away and became less important, and the themes that I ended up writing about sort of emerged on their own. And so then it was only with subsequent drafts that I also could get more ruthless, and I could also see more clearly when things didn't fit with my central theme. I'm not sure if that's something that you had a similar experience with.
Absolutely. I felt at the end of it I could have written 3 or 4 books and I had to choose which one I wanted to write. It's tricky, isn't it?
Yes, that is absolutely it. And that was another thing that I was going to say, actually, that I would have been really happy to have written a book that was War and Peace linked, because I had so many things that I wanted to tell and so many stories that I wanted to tell. But what I was really conscious of is that those weren't my stories. And so a lot of my book is retelling other people's stories with my story, weaving them together. And one of the things that I needed to make decisions about was a lot of those stories had trauma in them. They were either historical trauma, where people were recounting things that had happened to them in the past, or they were stories of current trauma. And I was really cognizant of what a privilege it is to tell somebody else's story. And so I tried to do that with respect and honesty. And sometimes just the stories that I really wanted to include, they didn't quite feel right to include them. So I ended up having to remove quite a few of the stories that I initially thought I was going to include. And Jay, if you were writing about other people, did you have a similar sort of experience?
Very much so, because you are very conscious that what you're reading and what you're writing is actually going to be read by real life people, and you need to do justice to those people. I think you're right. We could have a whole podcast on this, couldn't we?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the other things that I felt was really important to consider in what to include or not was the honesty about the conditions of the hospital and where I worked. And I wasn't sure if it would be okay for me to be telling that story. So I checked it very carefully with my Ethiopian colleagues from that time, because I wasn't sure if that would be disrespectful to explain some of the situations that were there. But they felt that it was really important, because there were injustices and there were perhaps things were done in not the correct way, and they were really happy to see that those things were documented, and however temporarily, to have a light shone on that.
Yeah, I'm interested, because this is really touching on another question I really wanted to ask you, which is about writing about other places and cultures. You know, we both did that, and you do need to have a sensitivity, I think, when you're doing that, when you're writing about someone else's country, someone else's culture, someone else's history. So what kind of sensitivity do you think that we need to keep in mind when we're doing that?
Well, one of the really vital things to remember is that I was writing from a place of privilege. So I was writing as a white middle-class Australian without a disability. And one of the key sensitivities is that inherent power imbalance in that. And it's been accepted for so long that the way to write about places other than the West is from a deficit model. So write about what they are in terms of what the West is not. And it has been particularly acceptable to write about Africa from a deficit narrative. So I was really guided by a lot of writers from the African diaspora. And in particular, there was a really good TED talk called The Danger of the Single Story. And that's from a Nigerian writer called Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And she writes about the risks of reducing complex human narratives to a simple narrative. And I was really conscious that the simple narrative that we have in Australia about Ethiopia is largely shaped by the famines of the 1980s and the attention of that got from Bob Geldof and Live Aid. And so there's a very real risk that we conflate writing about culture with events of the last 60 years or so. Is that something that you faced as well with writing about Poland and their experiences during the Second World War, Jay?
Very much so, and very much so the point that you made earlier about being conscious of trying not to tell people's stories, other people's stories, particularly when there was considerable trauma in that, as you say, for a lot of people.
Yes, yeah, there definitely is trauma. And I think there's also, there's a challenge that when we're writing about other people's cultures and we're trying very much not to shape it around their trauma or traumatic experiences, we want to represent complexity, but it's difficult to represent complexity in a simple way without resorting to cliches. So that's where it's really important to use the old writer's adage of show, don't tell. And that was absolutely a tension that still with me. It was really difficult to write this book, and it's really difficult to write the publicity information around it, because at every point I'm feeling this tension between writing my experience, which was working with very poor communities in a hospital that was very under-resourced, only 5 years after the end of a civil war that had sort of decimated a lot of social infrastructure, to be telling my experience about how that was without then fueling traditional stereotypical representations of Ethiopia is really, really challenging. And it's something I talk about in the afterword of the book, because I felt like I needed some kind of closing statement to say that I was conscious of that, but I still felt this need to detail what the unfair distribution of our planet's wealth looks like up close, because that's an experience that I've had that some people might be interested to read about.
Absolutely. And in fact, you're making me think about a really difficult problem I had when I came back and was writing the epilogue to my book, which is actually commenting on what Perth is like and Australia is like when you come back, and seeing some of that in a different light, I suppose. And you mentioned everyone talking about their kitchen renovations, which I found was really funny, because I actually had the same book, exactly the same reference in my book about the bathroom renovations, everyone talking about their bathroom renovations. And you do see that your own culture through a different lens after you've been away, don't you? I'm curious about any thoughts about that and then how you went about fitting back into life, you know, in Perth after everything you experienced.
So I laughed a lot when I read your book, because I think it's really common when people come back to Perth, they realise that, if you're not talking about bathroom renovations and kitchen renovations, it can be hard to find kind of an inroad into conversations. So in answer to your question, I settled back into Perth. The answer is that I didn't really. So I think I only lasted about 3 months back in Perth before I started looking online for jobs. And then I ended up getting a job with an international development organisation. Some people call that foreign aid. So I ended up moving to Melbourne and working in this foreign aid job, going to and from developing countries every 6 weeks. So I was spending about 3 months of my year outside of Australia in developing countries. And I studied a master's in international development. So then I immersed myself with work colleagues and study colleagues and built a new circle of friends that had similar sort of experiences as I had. Jay, I've got a little bit of a story if you're interested.
Absolutely.
Okay, so full disclosure, I did eventually buy a unit and I renovated my kitchen. And then I talked about it for ages to people.
Full disclosure, I actually just renovated my bathroom over Christmas, and I could talk about that until the cows came away.
Because it's really stressful to renovate a kitchen or a bathroom, I imagine.
Maybe you can take people out of Perth, but you can't take the Perth out of people.
Exactly. Well, for me, it was really stressful because it's a huge amount of money and a bewildering number of consumer options of just what kind of tap do you want? What kind of sink do you want? What kind of finish do you want on your kitchen doors? And the stakes were so high that if I got it wrong, then I was stuck with it for ages. So I did regale people with that story a lot. But then I had an extra complexity with my kitchen in that I had gone back to Ethiopia for some work that I was doing with Save the Children. And I had been on an evaluation of a water and sanitation program, and the dates got changed. So I flew back from Ethiopia the night before the tradies arrived to do the kitchen reno. And then it had been a really confronting evaluation because I was back in Ethiopia and I was seeing that this program had not actually been inclusive of kids with disabilities. And so I was now back in Australia and I was ripping out a daggy but still functional kitchen and replacing it with another kitchen that was trendier. And then the benchtop that they installed didn't look like the swatch that I had planned for. And so again, I was standing there feeling jet lagged, being cognizant that just the day before I'd been with kids in Ethiopia who didn't have any Braille resources and their teacher was teaching them Braille using pebbles so that they would know the Braille characters when their Braille resources did ever turn up. And those kids with disabilities, the toilets that had been installed by that NGO were not accessible for kids with disabilities. So the girls were having to wait until the boys were in class so the girls could use the boys' toilets. And there I was being upset because my kitchen benchtop didn't look like the swatch. So that added an extra element of stress to my kitchen renovation. And I ended up crying about my benchtop. It's 12 years later and I'm still talking about my kitchen renovation.
I think we can all relate to that on some level. But, you know, you give away there or you hint there at the kind of person that you are, which is, you know, someone that really wanted what you did with your career and your professional life and your personal time and effort commitment to matter and to make a difference for someone else. So I'm curious about how you look back now and the results of, you know, what you did and your time there. And I don't want to give everything away, obviously, because it's a great book and people should definitely take a read of it. But did you appreciate at the time what you ended up being part of while you were in Ethiopia?
No, I don't think so. I definitely didn't realise at the time. And I think we talked about this before. I don't know if anybody really appreciates at the time what they're a part of, because often it's the things we think that are significant end up not being significant. And it's not till later on that we reflect with hindsight about the things that ended up being significant. So I did go back to Ethiopia in 2010 and I went back again in 2013. And it was then that I started to get a sense of what I had been a part of. And now I am friends on Facebook with the former students from Gondar University, and I see all the stuff that they're up to. And it's only now with that benefit of many years hindsight that I can sort of reflect on what I was a part of.
Isn't it great? It's fantastic, you know. And I suppose on that, you know, and congratulations again on the Hungerford shortlisting. Well done, which is how we came to meet and to be here today. What do you think that things like the Hungerford Award represent for us as West Australian authors?
Oh, well, thanks. Thank you for the congratulations. I think that the Hungerford Award is, well, for me, it was a fabulous opportunity to have my story appraised just on its merits. So I had pitched to, I think, 6 or 7 publishers. And from what I hear, when you pitch your work to a publisher, your work is appraised. One of the things it's appraised on is its commercial viability, and it's appraised really quickly on the basis of your 300-word synopsis and your cover letter and your opening chapters. Whereas when you submit a story to a competition, you've got much more chance of it being fully read and read by a number of people that are really invested in finding good stories. So then the award gives the opportunity for your story to stand on its integrity and the depth and the potential of the unique tale that each of us who are submitting stories have got to tell. So I think for us, it really is, it's an unprecedented opportunity to launch your writing career essentially as an unknown writer.
Yeah, absolutely echo all of that. Very much my experience as well. And the value of persistence, which we talked about earlier on, of course. I mean, what other advice would you give to people out there who are thinking about writing their own stories?
Well, I think if we're talking about writing our own stories, as in writing memoir rather than writing fiction, because we've both written memoir / creative nonfiction, I think the first step is acknowledging to yourself that it can be quite confronting to write about yourself. And especially as Australians, because we're always sort of taught, oh, don't be full of yourself. But then, so then it can feel a bit audacious to write a story about yourself. But there is there's a growing interest in memoir as a genre. And so I put together some tips. So I think the number one tip is find some good resources that match your writing style. And I found a really good book called The Art of Memoir, which is written by Mary Carr. And we might put that in the show notes. And I found that was an excellent resource for distilling the emotional driving force behind my narrative. There are heaps and heaps of technical books out there, but for me that was really good. So I think spend some time researching to find a resource that matches where you're hoping to take your story. And then I think some other advice is to read really widely and read every kind of memoir you can get your hands on. Is that something that you did, Jay?
Definitely. Particularly at the end, I actually picked up some books that I wish I'd very much read at the beginning. It might have shortened the whole process for me. But I remember one piece of advice, which comes back to what we were talking about earlier. Don't be like the drunken uncle taking you by the elbow and leading you all over the garden path saying, let me tell you about this interesting thing. You know, you just have to make it clear that, you know, everything that you're telling has a point, everything has a purpose, and everything's leading towards something quite specific and deliberate. That's my tip that I often give to new writers coming in.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And I'm pretty sure that my first draft probably was like the drunken uncle leading all over the garden path. But and I think that is why reading widely is really important. So I compiled a bit of a list of the different kinds of memoirs that it's good to read. There's emotional memoirs, there's funny ones, technical ones. You can go really literary, like the sort of memoir that Robert Desai writes, or you can go to the opposite extreme of the memoir about Dewey the library cat, which is you need tissues for that one. And also it's a really good example of how to construct a narrative where everything contributes to the story, even if that story is about a cat in a library. And then I think there's also some really good audio resources. So there's lots of podcasts at the moment, and because podcasts are growing in popularity, I think that you can find some really good podcasts that demonstrate how to tell a personal story with some kind of universal emotional sort of resonance. So for me, one that I really recommend is called Alone, A Love Story. I'm not sure if that's one you've come across, Jay.
I haven't.
No, so that's a Canadian author who wrote a memoir and then decided, rather than publish it, that she would turn it into a podcast. And so it's a serialized version of her memoir, and it's raw and it's heart-wrenching, and listening to it while I was writing my own memoir, I was pulling so many tips on, right, that's how you keep the readers / listeners engaged. This is how you drive the narrative. You leave off everything else that's not absolutely critical for driving the narrative forward. And I think there's heaps of other audio sort of resources out there. So there's lots of different ways that you can sort of hone your craft, but the number one tip is just get in there and write it and be brave. And as we've talked about before, Jay, your first drafts, nobody's going to read it anyway. So just write what you feel like you need to write. And you've got so much time before what you write is going to get to the public eye that you'll have a chance to revise that and cut that out once you know that other people's eyes are going to be on it. So those would be my words of advice to aspiring memoirists.
Some great tips there, and a couple of books I might get the names of after we finish here. Sure. Thank you for that. So we are now going to have a reading from your book. Why don't you tell us the page number for those people who are at home who want to read along and listen to the excerpt that you've chosen.
Right. So I'll read to you from page 114, and this is a scene which is set in Gondar Hospital. I am Dr. Tesfai. Your new patient is here. Partial paraplegia resulting from TB of the spine. Just arrived to the ward now. The doctor indicated to the empty bed in the back corner where a slight teenage girl piggybacked a younger girl clutching two shopping bags. Clothes spilled out the top of the bags when the teenage girl gently lowered her passenger onto the bed. The older girl refilled the bags, then pulled the blankets back and straightened them over the patient's legs. She stashed the plastic bags beneath the bed and slid x-rays under the pillow. Her name is Habtam. Could you provide her with physiotherapy, please? The doctor was abrupt, but not unkind. My head swam. I had never treated a patient with TB before. It was rare to see a patient with TB in Australia. Usually, only specialist units would treat these patients from remote Aboriginal populations overseas, and then only for lung issues. I didn't even know it was possible to get TB in the spine. I recalled a lecture about TB in Cardiopulmonary Physiotherapy 205 back at Curtin Uni in 1995, but I hadn't taken much in as I'd only slept 2 hours the night before, having waited until the due date to complete an essay. If only I hadn't been sleep deprived back then, I might have remembered something useful for now. Habtam's file said she was 10 years old. She lay on her side in her bed looking morose. Big curls sitting close to her scalp framed her face. Can you please ask where her mother or father is? I asked. Habtam held her chin to her chest when Elias spoke to her. Not here, Elias translated, but she have her sister. Both girls looked nervous when Elias spoke to me in English. How old is her sister? I asked. 15 years old, he replied. When are her father and mother coming? Elias looked puzzled and said, not coming. Their village is 2 days' walk from here. Simply her sister is her attendant. Habtam's face still held the roundness and freshness of childhood, while her sister, sitting on the stool beside the bed, had the leaner face of an adult. Can we see her x-rays? Elias asked the sister, who bent Habtam's forward to fish under her pillow for the scans. The x-rays showed the mid part of her spine had collapsed in on itself, so her backbone formed a round curve coming to a point. A large mass was visible in the spine, clearly blocking the spinal cord below. When we examined Habtam's back, she was so thin her backbone was entirely visible. A sharp hunchback protruded at the point where her spine had collapsed in. We pulled back the covers to examine her lower limbs. Her thighs and calves had withered, leaving just slight muscle covering the visible bones. Can you bend your knees? Elias asked, but she couldn't. Her legs appeared to be completely paralysed.
Oh, thanks for that reading, Julie. I mean, it really just takes you back to or into that place, and certainly took me back to your book. Makes me want to read it all over again. I have to say, it's a great book and it's a great read. I'm curious, I mean, what would you say? You know, a lot of us, particularly at the moment, are you know thinking about how we can make the world a bit of a better place. You know, what can we do if you know if we're not able to go to Ethiopia and help children through physiotherapy?
Well, I would say that if you're the sort of person that's asking how to make the world a better place, there's a fairly good chance that you already are making the world a better place because there's an awful lot of people who are either ambivalent about making the world a better place or completely disinterested in doing so. So congratulations on step one. And I think also, particularly now, even much more so than when at the time that I went to Ethiopia, we are absolutely bombarded with different ways to make the world a better place. You've got all your social media, all these incoming requests from every different kind of charity, every different kind of social cause telling you you should be donating or you should be doing this differently. You've got all these visuals from Instagram influencers who are doing humble bragging about great things that they've done to make the world a better place, particularly with environmental issues that are a bit fashionable at the moment. And so I think it can be really overwhelming to know where to even begin. And so I'd say the first step is just be gentle with yourself. And as the title of a particularly great book says, small steps. Small steps are the way to get going. The world doesn't need grand gestures to become a better place. Not everybody is able to create grand gestures. And the most effective way, I think, is just taking small steps, being kind, making good decisions in everyday life. That would be my hot tip on how to make the world a better place.
I like it a lot, Julia. I like the reference to humble bragging. And I have to say, your book never comes across as anything but genuine, authentic, and really grappling with the complexities of the big and little challenges and difficulties that you had and the successes that you had as well. And it's a great read, and I was grateful for the opportunity to have the chance to do so. And it's been great to catch up with you today with all the listeners who are out there. We have talked about writing narrative nonfiction. We've talked about writing about travel and how small steps can end up having a big impact. And of course, we've shared our experiences of being members of the City of Fremantle Hungerford Award family, which is a great family to be part of. Julie, thank you so much for your time today. And thank you, listeners, for being part of the Fremantle Press podcast, which is brought to you with support from the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe to the Fremantle Press podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your favourite podcasts from. I'm Jay Martin, standing in today for Rebecca Hickey on this podcast and interviewing Julie Sprigg on her newly released book, Small Steps. Highly recommended. And thank you, Julie, for your time.
Thanks, Jay. It was great to be here.